It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Yeah, we're not afraid here and declare your independence with me, Ernest Hancock, from Phoenix, Arizona, in the BEA beautiful studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com. Now, today is a very special show. I'm going to get to be able to be reacquainted with my good friend, Karen Kwiatkowski. Now, Karen, I got you there, Karen.
Yes, you do. Okay, now
this is what I'm going to do. I want to introduce you a little bit from my perspective here, and then we're going to get reacquainted over the next couple of hours with the audience, and they are going to learn a lot. Call your friends. Download this archive. Share it with everyone. You're going to get edumacated like yesterday. Yesterday we had a great show. I'm just giving you one after another you need to share so that you can share with your friends all this information that you're going to need to know. You will be amazed. I want to read from a recent article by Karen Kwiatkowski and Lou Rockwell this one paragraph and tell you who she is and why it's so important that we're talking to her. Thinking people everywhere see our Afghanistan experience as a crash of 20th century American empire on the 21st century rocks of reality. The contradiction of our empire happening today in monetary as well as military terms is at least a full generation overdue. The false sustenance of a financial bubble corresponds with the failing sustenance of military empire. Our children are the first generation who are not citizens, but Caesar's slaves, bound to a life of fear and labor made bearable only by their inchoate dreams of freedom. The military-industrial complex, a benign tumor in the days of Eisenhower, has metastasized to the extent that generals run Washington and the Fourth Estate exists solely to serve the imperial machine. Now, let me tell you who Karen Kwiatkowski is. Karen is a retired United States Air Force lieutenant colonel that was in the Pentagon for several things. One, when it got hit on 9/11, and we'll talk briefly about that. But the thing that was very interesting, she was right next to the Office of Special Plans. This is Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney's thing. And, you know, after I talked to you today, Karen, this is what I did. I went back and I go, and you know, I remember interviewing, the first time I interviewed you. And then, of course, we had you on Charles Goyette's show a lot and really got to know you. And you're a speaker at the Freedom Summit. Oh, yeah. FreedomSummit.com. First weekend in December. Charles Goyette will be one of the speakers there. His new book, The Dollar Meltdown, just got picked up. It only came out in October. It just got picked up and is going to be translated in Chinese. I'm like, man, you get translated in Chinese. Heck, if only a fraction of a percent buys the dang book, man, you're styling. So what's happened is we got to know Karen, and I don't know why you haven't written a book. You need to write a book. But this is what happened. In May 9th of 2004, you and I did a show. The next day, an article that you wrote, the new Pentagon Papers that came out in Salon.com, you remember that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when that came out, then the 16th, we did a show on, and I was listening to that show after the big hoopla of the new Pentagon Papers coming out. Now, this is where I want to start our story for our audience. Karen Kwiatkowski was clandestinely outing these guys. She knew there was a drum for war that was all based on lies. She knew that was her job. She knew what was it. We're going to talk about this, but then you got that out. How? Now, Colonel Hackworth had a site. Now, this is, you know, we're still in the early days of the internet. Even 5 years ago, it wasn't near the bandwidth and stuff that we have now. So I'm going to go ahead and have you go ahead and get us, our audience, up to speed that don't know who you are, possibly haven't spent time with you. It's a new audience here. And Karen, would you please go ahead and tell the story of how you're in the Pentagon and what prompted you to go ahead and write under a pseudonym for Colonel Hackworth's page?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it was in the I was transferred into the Office of Secretary of Defense. I had been working in African Affairs, kind of a backwater, and I got moved in the spring of 2001. Spring of 2002, I moved into Near East South Asia. And Near East South Asia, of course, covers the Middle East. And that's, you're talking, you know, the Iraq and Iran issues, Afghanistan, those things. So I moved in there, and I do plans and I brief, you know, I write papers that, keep the guys above us informed. Now, my boss is a guy named Bill Lutey, who used to work for Dick Cheney, who Dick Cheney put in there to be in charge of Near East South Asia policy. As soon as the Bush administration had come in, Cheney, in fact, Bill Lutey came from Cheney's staff directly over into the Pentagon. What he's doing is, in the summer of 2002, is we're bringing in a lot more people to work in the office. And these people are not military like me or civil servants, per se. Most of them are political appointees. And I got to meet some of them because we were hot bunking it, sharing the same space. And in the summer of 2002, these guys come in, and, you know, they're all pretty much, you know, pro-Israel, anti-Arab. This comes out in conversation, okay? The tone and tenor of the perspectives in that office is supposed to be apolitical, supposed to be, you know, constitutional in that way. But really, it wasn't very agenda oriented, and that struck me as strange.
If Iraq didn't do it, they're going to do it. Let's go get them.
Oh yeah, very much anti-Iraq and Saddam Hussein, which they would share. The anti-Saddam Hussein sentiment would be shared by many military people because a lot of the guys in the Pentagon at the lieutenant colonel and colonel level, many of them had time in the first, pushing the Iraqis out, the first Gulf War, basically when we pushed the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and then pushed into Iraq to some extent. And many of these military people felt in just a very functional way that, in a fundamental way, they felt, well, you know, the job wasn't finished. And, of course, we all heard this. We read about this whole view that, well, we should have just gone in and done it. And Bush 41, failed, you know, in actually adhering to what the Congress had allowed him to do and what the UN had said to do. So, you know, there was that sentiment, anti-Saddam Hussein, but this sentiment of these appointees and the political views went further, and I didn't know what it was. I came later to find out that these people shared the philosophy called neoconservatism, which is not necessarily new, and it's certainly not conservative, but that's kind of what they were. And it struck me as something interesting and something different and a little bit of concern. Also, the people were very much inexperienced in policy making and had no previous background. It wasn't like they'd come in from a previous administration. They were off the street in a sense, but they weren't really off the street. They were out of these neoconservative think tanks, American Enterprise Institute and places like that. Anyway, in the summer, it gets crowded with these folks. In August, the people that had come in over the summer, this group I'm talking about, found separate office space. They would still report to Bill Lutey, our boss, but they basically became our sister organization. This is the briefing that we had in August by Bill Lutey. He brings everybody in for a staff meeting. We sit there, and he says, well, we've got the new space. These guys are moving up into this other space. It's upstairs. We're on the fourth floor. These guys would be on the fifth floor. And they're called special plans. That's their official name. The next thing out of Bill Lutey's mouth is, but don't say that to anybody. We're going to know them as the expanded Iraq desk I think somebody might have asked a question, and they said, well, special plans might raise alms. Make sure the joint staff, don't talk to your friends in the joint staff. That's the military planning side. that works directly for the chairman of the GCS, don't tell any of those guys it's special plans. It's just the expanded Iraq desk because we're going to war with Iraq. Of course, the summer of 2002, as you remember, lots of news stories. You know, Saddam Hussein linking him to, you know, 9/11, linking him to weapons of mass destruction, a number of speeches, and not so many of the speeches, but really just newspaper articles.
War drums. And so I want to ask you right there, you know, the special plans, I mean, they called it special plans themselves, and then they didn't want anybody else calling them special plans?
That's kind of funny. I think,
Well, we got the break coming up. We'll get to that when we come back, because it's well known now, the Office of Special Plans. Well, whose plan? What plan? Plan for who? For what? Are we living a plan now? I don't know. Somebody's always got a plan for us. Can we have our own plan? Well, we'll talk about it when we come back with Karen Kwiatkowski, Lieutenant Colonel retired from the Air Force in the Pentagon.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Declare your independence, Phoenix, Arizona, with Karen Kwiatkowski, which is Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Air Force, from the Pentagon. And I'm very interested in this special plans thing. And when they say special plans, I know somebody had to raise their hand and go, what special plan?
Yeah, exactly. Well, people didn't know what it really was, but it was explained to us by the boss, Bill Luddy. Cheney's acolyte, that it would be the expanded Iraq desk. Now, they never really explained why the Iran desk was also included in special plans. And of course, the Iran desk was headed at that time by a real famous guy now called Larry Franklin, who we also worked with. And of course, Larry got in huge trouble. He never served a day in prison for all that, but he was FBI charged him with providing information, classified information to AIPAC. And to the embassy.
Well, it wasn't just him. There's a bunch of people.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, they brought the Iran desk and the Iraq desk up into the new spaces that they needed, called it special plans, told us not to tell anybody it was special plans, which is kind of goofy. And anyway, I mean, that's just crazy to keep. I mean, that's not even a secret. I mean, this is just almost like little kids playing games. But, you know, it just kind of raises, you know, causes you to raise your eyebrows. In any case, there was another announcement that he made at that same meeting, and he said, this office will be headed by a guy named Abe Schultz. He, of course, we knew, nice guy. And Abe, who was in charge of the Office of Special Plans, would sign off on all talking points that covered any topic that OSD, the Office of Secretary of Defense, was interested in the categories terrorism, WMD, and Iraq. So...
Okay, now let's go ahead and remind people who was Secretary of Defense at the time.
Rumsfeld, of course. Rumsfeld was our Secretary of Defense, and Paul Wolfowitz was the deputy. So all of us in Near East South Asia and also our other directorates that did the other regions of the world, you know, all the desk officers, the action officers, we're doing the same thing. We're preparing briefings. We're escorting people who want to meet with the higher-ups. You know, we're researching intelligence, we're using intelligence, we're not producing intelligence, which is key to remember when we read about special plans, because, of course, what they did is actually produce their own intelligence and pass it off as if it was the real thing. But in any case, we would generally, if we were certainly Near East South Asia, we would be talking about topics such as weapons of mass destruction, Iraq or Saddam Hussein, and terrorism. We would be mentioning these things. We were instructed at that meeting in late August, that when we did papers from now on, we would call one of the guys up in Office of Special Plans, and they would we'd tell them what we had to brief and when it was, and a day or so later, they would provide us with a set of talking points on those topics. At that point, when we received those electronically on the classified system, we would incorporate them into whatever we were writing, but we had to incorporate them very carefully, exactly verbatim, no deletions, no modifications, no changes. It had to be incorporated precisely and absolutely Exactly.
Okay, wait. Time out. Okay, so this is, you're an experienced, well, in the intelligence community at the Pentagon, your job was to take raw intel that would
I'm a customer of intelligence. All of us who are working in Near East South Asia, unless we are detailed from the department, from Defense Intelligence Agency, we are engaged as customers of intelligence. So we look at the intelligence that's already been produced, and we take bits and pieces of it that are pertinent to whatever we're briefing, to whatever documents we're putting together, whatever planning documents we're creating for the higher ups. And we would take, normally we would search through intelligence products, which go through a very rigorous process in order to be put in a DIA report or a CIA report.
Okay, so you're Maxwell Smart in the new movie.
So.
I mean, you know, I just saw that movie. Yeah, I love that movie.
Okay.
I went and bought it.
Yeah.
You're a great analyst. You bring in all the raw data. You know, you got all the goodies in here, and you're doing a present. Give me what you know on Iran.
We say to the intel, give us what you know. And intel would provide us the information through various reports that they have and various ways that we would access their products. And we would take what we needed from those products to prepare and to round out whatever briefing that we're doing. So we're bringing in an ambassador from Syria, let's say. We need to know what's going on in Syria, okay? What's going on in the neighbors of Syria? And so in a case like that, I would need terrorism and WMD information, and I might need information on their neighbor, Iraq. If I needed those things in the past prior to special plans, I would look through the intel. I would talk to the intel people, and they'd tell me, well, here's what we think we know, here's what we're pretty sure we know, here's what we know for sure, et cetera. And I would use that to frame and support my primary product, which was a paper or something to, you know, a briefing and whatnot, to go up the chain. Now, once special plans is formed, we stop thinking, and we're instructed to stop thinking. We're instructed to stop analyzing. We're instructed to stop talking to intelligence. Stop talking to DIA, because you no longer have to do that. You will now call special plans, which is not intelligence, okay? They had one intel guy up there when they first started, one intel guy. The rest of them were just a bunch of political appointees off the street, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, let me go ahead and summarize this. I want to make this clear for the audience. Prior to the Office of Special Plans, you would take all of this information and you would consolidate it in a summary form that would be useful for those policymakers and executive branch and whoever that's got to make a decision based on information.
Right. And in our
after
papers,
that,
we would say, DIA says this, CIA says this. If there was a conflict, we could say, DIA says this, but we have a different opinion from CIA on this. If it was important, that's what we would bring forward. But
so
no
now
longer.
We have the Office of Special Plans that says it's headed by big bad guys, and they say, all right, you're not doing
here's
that anymore. You're going to, whenever you're asked for whatever document that you're going to get, this is where we're going to insert what we want into the system.
Right. That's right.
So we're going to tell you in this, because you're the guys that, you know, create these pieces of paper, we're going to tell you what goes on those pieces of paper.
That's exactly right. On the topics of interest to them, which were Iraq, WMD, and terrorism.
Okay.
So we no longer had to think, and it actually made our job easier, and we all complied. We all complied with it. There were no rebels that said, oh, I'm not going to do this. There were people that complained and also people that laughed when they saw what was coming out of special plans as, you know, the truth, when in fact we looked at the actual intelligence and we knew what they were doing. You could see how they were mixing and matching and cherry-picking and deleting and actually, in some cases, actually lying. Okay, and one of the things, and I'll give you this example real brief just to give you a flavor. Special plans had a bullet, had a phrase, in this several-page set of talking points that we were supposed to use and that we had to use. And one of those referred to this infamous meeting, so-called meeting in Prague, Czechoslovakia, between one of the 9/11 terrorists and one of Saddam Hussein's intelligence people. Now, that's a pretty heavy, you know, that's pretty incriminating, right? I mean, this is connecting this, if it were true, this would seem to be a connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11, right?
Something they really wanted to make that connection.
Like, yeah. So, anyway, the FBI, CIA, the whole intelligence community had known for, I think, more than a year that this was not true. They put it out in the reports. This was not true. Someone reported it, but we checked it out. And the people that they're saying were here and there, we found out where they really were, and it wasn't in Prague, and it wasn't together. Okay? So this had been in the intelligence, and yet, Abe Schulsky, Bill Luddy, the guys in Office of Special Plans are promulgating a known falsehood. This is just one example. There's others, but that's the one I think that hits home.
Well, when we come back here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and retired Lieutenant Colonel from the Pentagon, Karen Kwiatkowski, we got time. We're going to get this in the archive. We're going to walk it through. We're just summarizing here because these things have consequences, and we're going to find out what they are and how they affect your life right now. We'll be right back.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Less conversation, a little more action, please. All this aggravation ain't satisfaction in me.
The United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The military-industrial complex. And the one thing that we want to make sure we understand is that this was General Eisenhower, then his farewell speech as President of the United States. And here's a general. I mean, he was the head SOB in charge, man. This is a guy, D-Day, the Allied forces. And he understood, and he was fearful of anyone that would take that position without the understanding that he had of just how terrible a power this was. So where are we at now? They not only do they have the power, they've expanded the power, and they've short-circuited the power with things like the Office of Special Plans. There is always somewhere that you can get injected into the matrix what you want so that you can do what you want. They created an entirely new department, and they were unlucky enough, as is always the case throughout history, to do it in front of Karen Kwiatkowski. Now, the thing is that this is, I wanted to give you an opportunity to go ahead and finish some examples in your story, but I want to get up to the point where you started writing about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was about the same time frame, even before the Office of Special Plans had actually moved out of our spaces. In the summer of 2002, we, the Pentagon, Guys Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, the things that they're saying publicly, and the things that are coming out as news about Iraq in particular, were not backed up by intelligence. Okay, they were not backed up by intelligence. And you know, we were saying, oh, Saddam Hussein is connected to 9/11. Well, we knew, intelligence community knew that was not the case. In fact, Saddam Hussein had two enemies. One was United States, and the other was Al Qaeda, led by Bin Laden. To the extent that he was led by. That it was led by Bin Laden. Bin Laden was an avowed enemy, mutually so, of Saddam Hussein. You think about what Bin Laden was about. You know, he was about Wahhabist, Islamic, traditional purity type. You know, a very strict and fundamentalist view of Sunni Islam. Okay, that's one part of it. Bin Laden was a Saudi, of course. He had complained bitterly and actually said this was one of the reasons of his attacks for the American, you know, we had infidel armies in the land of Mecca. Okay, these are his concerns. So he, for all of his warped and insane madness, he is religiously oriented. He would like to see religious rule. What's Saddam Hussein doing, right, just north of Saudi Arabia? Well, Saddam Hussein is a Marxist, okay? Saddam Hussein is employing women and putting them in positions of power. And as we remember, one of the most dangerous people, one of the 52 most wanted deck of cards in Iraq was a woman. Well, you know, Saddam Hussein is no traditionalist Muslim. He certainly was not running a state in accordance with any type of Sharia or fundamentalist Wahhabist values. So anyway, they're avowed enemies, and the intel community knew this. So first off, Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11, and yet people in the Pentagon, such as, you know, our Secretary of Defense and Deputy Secretary of Defense, fed by guys like Bill Luddy, who was my boss, and guys like Abe Sholsky, who ran the Office of Special Plans. And, of course, Abe was in the Pentagon from the beginning. He was Office of Special Plans leader before Office of Special Plans was formally announced or even formed. I mean, he is one of the leading neoconservative thinkers at that time, pushing forth an agenda. And, of course, that agenda was to demonize Saddam Hussein, such that the American people would accept a war with him. Now, this is happening in the summer of 2002. I'm getting kind of frustrated because it seems to me that something very strange is happening, something that is not going by the rules, as I understood them to be, as far as intelligence produces the intelligence, policy is based on fact, not emotion, or fact, not on politics, even, to some extent. And so here was a drive, a push to
massage the facts
for war. Yeah, with no intelligence substance to it whatsoever. In fact, falsehoods being told not just by special plans to the world in the sense that they're leaking stuff. I mean, the other thing that bothered me and I think got me frustrated was documents in our office that had some of this cherry-picked intelligence, which we would condemn individually and say, well, that's not really, you know, I see what they're doing, but you know, they're not looking at the whole picture. And we would see that verbatim in the New York Times. Of course, we didn't know anything about Miller, the reporter who was, you know, had her ties with Scooter Libby. You know, we didn't know that. I mean, we're sitting here going, how'd that happen? Why is false information being leaked almost verbatim? First off, it's false. Second off, it's being leaked. What's going on here? Well, anyway, my frustration was growing and growing. And I began to write short little essays for me and really short ones. You know, 800 words or whatever, and wrote for me just to relieve some of the stress that I was feeling, like, hey, is anybody out there? Am I the only one here that thinks this is nuts? And I would share them with some of my friends who would laugh and would agree with me, saying, yeah, it's really crazy, and you ought to hear what's going on in our end of the spectrum. And
well, how would you disseminate this information? You put it on the Pentagon email system?
I use the Pentagon system. My friends are all in the Pentagon.
So it's not a secret, I just like
the people that use this, you know, they shop online when they're supposed to be working. Yeah, I mean, anybody with a computer in the Pentagon, like, I mean, heck, I'll just tell you this, and your listeners probably already know this, especially if they're in the military at the time. When Bill Clinton was the president, I think that was 8 years of presidency, military was not a great fan of Bill Clinton for the most part. Certainly the officer corps didn't care for him. We used to send all kinds of nasty old jokes about Bill and Hill on the government internet. Nobody got in trouble. Couldn't do that under Bush. That not that I would, you know, I never forwarded that kind of thing, but I was on the receiving end of a lot of these jokes about Clinton. Now, when Bush got elected, he was very popular for some reason, even though he's like, apparently, you know, he didn't serve out his National Guard time, and, you know, he basically followed the Bill Clinton path of how not to serve your country. But, you know, they liked him. There were no George Bush jokes. You wouldn't, you know, if you were sitting there looking at the, what was that blog they had, the monkey, something with the, there was a monkey blog, a blog about it that used to pick on George Bush all the time.
Yeah, I know.
You wouldn't be caught looking at that on the government computer. But in any case, yeah, wrote them for the most part on the government computer, sent them out from the government computer. I even posted to, on the unclassified network, you know, I posted them directly to once I was had been writing for a while for
Military Week or
Hackworth, David Hackworth, yeah, who passed away a few years ago. But yeah, I post this stuff directly from the computer. Now, you know, this is the, like you said, nature of the internet. Government doesn't want these things to happen. I know after I retired, they banned blogging unless it was approved by a public affairs officer. You couldn't put if you're a soldier in Iraq and Afghanistan, or you're one that came back and you wanted to blog and share pictures and thoughts and stories, you couldn't do that. It used to be they could do that, but the government kind of got wise to it. And they've also, I think, since I left, put restrictions on memory cards and stuff like that, because that's a way of getting information, whether it's classified or unclassified, out of the corridors of power and into independent media. Now, I'm writing these stories for my own entertainment, try to keep my sanity. I'm frustrated by the lying. I've never seen such lying, conscious and promulgated, I've never seen that. Just very weird. You know, incompetence, I'd seen incompetence. This was not incompetence. This was agenda setting based on falsehoods.
Oh, no, this is death and dying. This is bad. So we knew the drums were being beaten loud and loud and constant, and it was like, you know, already done. They were just connecting the dots. Now, when we come back, I want you to, you know, get right to the point. You're going on Colonel Hackworth. Did you talk to him? How did he know? Did he know who you really were? When did they find out who you really were? And how come they couldn't find out? And because they weren't looking for a woman, couldn't be a woman. Well, we're going to talk with Karen.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Independence of me, Ernest Hancock, Karen Kwiatkowski. She asked that very question. What the heck are we fighting for? In fact, there's a movie, Why We Fight, that she was prominently featured in that I thought was fantastic. You know, we're going to talk about that, too. There's a bunch of things I want to talk about, but I want to get through this part. That we, you know, Colonel Hackworth, let me ask you some questions. Mm-hmm. Did he know who you were?
I don't know if he did. I don't know. I mean, when I first contacted him, actually, I have to tell you the truth. When I first wrote these essays, I sent them to Lou Rockwell. And I said, I didn't know him either, and he didn't know me. And he liked them, but he said, I don't publish anything anonymously. That's his policy, and he doesn't publish anonymous work. And I said, well, if I publish this with my name on it, I'm going to be sent somewhere, probably Leavenworth, and I don't want to do that. So then I contacted Hackworth. Now, I didn't know Hackworth, and I had no intermediate party who knew Hackworth. I just went to Soldiers for the Truth, his website that he ran at the time, and emailed him. And I emailed him a sample of some of these essays.
Well, give some history of Colonel Hackworth. He was very well known in what, Vietnam as...
Korea also, yeah.
Yeah, the ultimate soldier.
Yep,
I love the soldiers.
And he's not one of these, a person who would be pro-women in the military either, I don't believe.
Well, Charles Goyette had him, during the build-up to the war, Charles had him on regularly being his personal Secretary of Defense, because he knew a lot of the stuff that he knew that was going on was because of you.
Well, I'll tell you this, some of it that he knew because of me, but I believe that the reason Hackworth accepted those articles and immediately... agreed, said, if you'll do these frequently or regularly, you know, you're going to have a place on my website. I want to get this information out. I believe the reason he did that, not knowing me, was because it confirmed what he had already been told by many people, not just one or two people, but many people, including people he knew that and trusted. So here's somebody coming in. Yeah, he doesn't know Karen Kwiatkowski. You know, he doesn't know me. We never met. We never did meet. But what I'm saying rang true to him. And I didn't know this at the time, but I believe, I've come to believe over the years, that it rang true to him because he had already been hearing it. Because, you know, I had a friend over in the OSD section that does SOLIC, Special Operations and Low Intensity Conflict. This guy was a Special Forces guy in the past. He was now a civilian. So he's kind of working in this macho, war-making type of, under-the-radar type area. And he liked the essays. He said, yeah, you wouldn't believe some of the stuff they're pulling over here in my area. So, I think many, many people, and this is an incrimination of all of us, okay?
Well, a lot of people
Many people were exposed to this and knew it. Most of them simply either ignored it, went along with it until their term was up, or actually worked to get transferred out. And I actually retired as soon as I could. I retired. But in the meantime, I tried to do as much damage as I could through these essays. And, of course, I did talk with some of the Knight Ritter newspaper people before when I was still active duty. I didn't give them any classified information. I just, in another way, I confirmed what they already knew from their sources.
Now, a lot of people in the Pentagon, people, your friends, family, such, I mean, there's somebody inside those walls knew that was you, didn't they?
Well, lots of my friends did, sure.
The impression I got is that they were hunting you. They wanted to know who the hell is this person.
Well, they didn't travel in the same circles as I did, I guess.
Well, I mean, they didn't have, I tell you the first thing, especially when you're dealing with Cheney and Rumsfeld, and Feith and Leibowitz, all these guys, Wolfowitz, these guys, it never occurred to them that it was a woman.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. And also, I don't think they even thought someone would, I guess in retrospect, there was risk involved. I didn't necessarily feel there was a huge amount of risk. Like I said, many of my friends knew this. Plus, I didn't write one way but say, yes, they're three bags full during the duty day. I verbalized my concerns, okay, to my boss, my immediate supervisor, who worked for Lutie. So, I think they understood. I mean, if they'd ever wanted to find out, that I had not been dishonest in the least about my opinions. Now, the other thing is...
Yeah, you go ahead. Let's go to trial. I want a trial.
Yeah, well... I didn't release any classified information. None of these essays did anything except cast to cast a harsh light on what it is that they were doing.
Were you afraid that they would be considered illegal?
Well, disrespecting. Sure, if you make jokes about Rumsfeld, that's disrespecting one of your superiors publicly. I'd get in trouble for that. Now, In real damage, is that a big deal? No, it's not a big deal, and they probably wouldn't.
It is that Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense.
Sure, yeah. I mean, come on. Everybody was doing. I had been trained during the Clinton years that it was okay to make fun of the boss. We did it all the time, the time when Clinton was president. And this is long before Monica Lewinsky. Just an amazing amount of disrespect in the uniformed military hallways about that guy. So I guess in a way, I was a product of that. So if you can disrespect one president, you got to be able to disrespect all of them. Now, quite frankly,
especially when they deserve it.
Yeah. I don't know how hard they really looked. I don't know how much damage it did. All I know is writing these essays helped me think about what was really true and what was not true, what was really important. It helped me think about that. It really was for me. Now, if it helped other people that read those essays, I think.
Well, it prompted you to also retire early.
Well, yeah, it sure did. Absolutely, I wasn't going to work in that. It was just corrupted, and I had spent 19 years in the military, and none of the experiences I had caused me to lose faith in the institution. And I even worked in acquisitions, which is the most horrendously wasteful, bureaucratic monster that you can imagine. And even then, I didn't quit over that. This was something extreme, and it really was a hijacking of a foreign policy, not by the Pentagon, but by a small group of political appointees within the Pentagon.
Well,
and
it's worse than that.
They did it. People count the deaths, okay?
Exactly. People died. People were killed. People died. People lost faith. This was bad on so many levels. This is Star Wars kind of evil empire-ish, dark side stuff. So I get it. I feel for you, sister. And I'm glad that you did it. Now the thing was is that then you come out. So the Salon thing comes up. You know, the Pentagon Papers, now, who actually wrote that?
The Salon article?
Yeah, you wrote it.
The way it came out, here's the story of when I retired and left the Pentagon in March. I was on terminal leave. At that point, I began publishing with my name, even though I was still technically owned by the military. I was retired out. I was on terminal leave. I wrote for Lou Rockwell. I wrote a number of articles for Lou Rockwell. I get a call in May, I think it was late May, by a guy who I did not know, and he said his name was Jim Webb. And I said, okay, because, you know, I don't know Jim Webb.
The congressman?
He goes, yeah, Jim Webb. Well, he's a senator now. He said Jim Webb, former Naval Secretary of the Navy under Reagan. And I'm like, oh, crap, yeah, I know who you are. Yeah, fantastic. What do you need? And he said, well, I think you should write a short article for a newspaper publication. He apparently had been reading some of the stuff I'd been writing early on for Lou Rockwell, which was along the same themes as what I wrote for Hackworth. Okay, so he's apparently, Jim Webb read some of these things and said what you need to, and of course, why would Jim Webb call me? Okay, why? Not just because he likes what I write at Lou Rockwell, because what I write at Lou Rockwell reflects what his contacts are telling him. You know, it's all, you know, we listen to what we think is true, what we believe to be true. Jim Webb already knew what was going on. He read my stuff and he said, well, one more nail in the coffin. Anyway, he advised me and offered to help, which he did help me write a short op-ed piece. And then he, Jim Webb, shopped it out to all the major newspapers where he was published, because he, of course, wrote occasional articles himself. All the major newspapers, every one of his contacts, every one of the editors turned him down, every one of them. He was frustrated because, you know, he has more pull than some people, but it didn't work. They didn't want to touch it. And this is in June. We've already invaded Iraq, for God's sake. And the article I wrote simply said, if you have questions, maybe you ought to look into what the OSP was doing. That's the article, okay? That's what I wrote about. And I suggested some places to look. Nobody wanted
they
to touch it.
They don't want to look. They had already committed. They were part of it.
They were by the same government that was buying these lies and promulgating the lies.
Yeah, they were part of the problem.
Yep. So I eventually, after all these rejections came back through Jim Webb, and he tells me, sorry, you know, I tried. And, he had helped me write it to some extent to make it sound the right way, succinct and that. Anyway, so then I contacted the same people over at Knight Ridder newspapers. At the time it was Knight Ridder. I think they've got a new name now. The company was divided up. Anyway, Knight Ridder newspaper people did publish it. Of course, they had been doing a fine job of reporting. They also knew that what I said was just a little bit of the truth. They knew what was going on. This confirmed their belief, and so they published it. And that was in early August of 2003.
Well, we're going to have to pick it up after the break. They're amping up the volume. We'll go ahead and make sure that we get the Salon article got out, and then the fan, you know, was sullied. And I tell you, this is going to be a point in history. There's a times in history. There's before certain things, and there's after certain things. Well, the recognition of the existence of the Office of Special Plan is one of those points in history. And it's something that we knew, not in time, but there was a lot of other bad stuff that happened even after that. Who's to blame? It was the lamestream media. The media so last century was continuing their crap right now. We'll be right back.